this was a deficiency when the investigators brought in the case. He's had 5 months to anticipate that we might go this way, and if he is good, as I'm sure he is, then he's been quietly getting ready for us to go in this direction. Wouldn't that come out in the discovery material? Not always. There is an art to discovery. Most of the time, it's what is not in the discovery file that is important and that you have to watch out for. Jeffrey Golentz is a seasoned pro. He knows just what he has to put in and what he can keep for himself. You know Golentz. You've gone to trial against him before. I don't know him and have never gone up against him. It's his reputation I know. He's never lost a trial. He's something like 27-0. I checked my watch. The time had passed quickly, and I needed to keep things moving if I was going to pick my daughter up on time. Okay, I said. There are a couple other things we need to cover. Let's talk about whether you testify. That's not a question. That's a given. I want to clear my name. The jury will want me to say, I did not do this. I knew you were going to say that, and I appreciate the fervor I see in your denials. But your testimony has to be more than that. It has to offer an explanation, and that's where we can get into trouble.
I don't care.
Did you kill your wife and her lover?
No.
Then why did you go out there to the house?
I was suspicious. If she was there with somebody, I was going to confront her and throw him out on his ass.
You expect this jury to believe that a man who runs a half-billion-dollar movie studio took the afternoon off to drive out to Malibu to spy on his wife?
No, I'm no spy. I had suspicions, and went out there to see for myself, and to confront her with a gun.
Elliot opened his mouth to speak, but then hesitated and didn't respond. You see, Walter, I said, you get up there, and you open yourself up to anything, most of it not good. He shook his head.
I don't care. It's a given. Guilty guys don't testify. Everybody knows it. I'm testifying that I did not do this.
He poked a finger at me with each syllable of the last sentence. I still liked his forcefulness. He was believable. Maybe he could survive on the stand. Well, ultimately it is your decision, I said. We'll get you prepared to testify, but we won't make the decision until we get into the defense phase of the trial, and we see where we stand.
It's decided now. I'm testifying.
His face began to turn a deep shade of crimson. I had to tread lightly here. I didn't want him to testify, but it was unethical for me to forbid it. It was a client decision, and if he ever claimed I took it away from him or refused to let him testify, I would have the bar swarming me like angry bees. Look, Walter, I said, you're a powerful man. You run a studio and make movies and put millions of dollars on the line every day. I understand all of that. You are used to making decisions with nobody questioning them. But when we go into trial, I'm the boss. And while it will be you who makes this decision, I need to know that you are listening to me and considering my counsel. There's no use going further if you don't. He rubbed his hand roughly across his face. This was hard for him.
Okay, I understand. We make a final decision on this later.
He said it grudgingly. It was a concession he didn't want to make. No man wants to relinquish his power to another. Okay, Walter, I said. I think that puts us on the same page. I checked my watch again. There were a few more things on my list and I still had some time.
Okay, let's move on, I said.
Please.
I want to add a couple people to the defense team. They will be
No, I told you. The more lawyers a defendant has, the guiltier he looks. Look at Barry Bonds. Tell me people don't think he's guilty. He's got more lawyers than teammates.
Walter, you didn't let me finish. These are not lawyers I'm talking about, and when we go to trial, I promise it is going to be just you and me sitting at the table.
Then who do you want to add?
A jury selection consultant, and somebody to work with you on image and testimony, all of that.
No jury consultant. Makes it look like you're trying to rig things.
Look, the person I want to hire will be sitting out in the gallery. No one will notice her. She plays poker for a living and just reads people's faces and looks for tells. Little giveaways, that's it.
No, I won't pay for that mumbo-jumbo.
Are you sure, Walter?
I spent 5 minutes trying to convince him, telling him that picking the jury might be the most important part of the trial. I stressed that in circumstantial cases,
the priority had to be in picking jurors with open minds, ones who didn't believe that just because the police or prosecution say something, it's automatically true. I told him that I prided myself on my skills in picking a jury, but that I could use the help of an expert who knew how to read faces and gestures. At the end of my plea, Elliot simply shook his head. Mumbo jumbo. I will trust your skills. I studied him for a moment and decided we'd talked enough for the day. I would bring up the rest with him the next time. I had come to realize that while he was paying lip service to the idea that I was the trial boss, there was no doubt that he was firmly in charge of things. And I couldn't help but believe it might lead him straight to prison. By the time I dropped Patrick back at his car in downtown and headed to the valley in heavy evening traffic, I knew I was going to be late and would tip off another confrontation with my ex-wife. I called to let her know, but she didn't pick up, and I left a message. When I finally got to her apartment complex in Sherman Oaks, it was almost 7:40, and I found mother and daughter out at the curb, waiting. Haley had her head down and was looking at the sidewalk. I noticed she had begun to adopt this posture whenever her parents came into close proximity of one another. It was like she was just standing on the transporter circle and waiting to be beamed far away from us. I popped the locks as I pulled to a stop, and Maggie helped Haley into the back with her school backpack and her overnight bag. "Thanks for being on time," she said in a flat voice. "No problem," I said, just to see if it would put the flares in her eyes. "Must be a hot date if you're waiting out here for me." "No, not really. Parent-teacher conference at the school." That got through my defenses and hit me in the jaw. "You should have told me. We could have gotten a babysitter and gone together."
"I'm not a baby," Haley said from behind me.
"We tried that," Maggie said from my left. "Remember? You jumped on the teacher so badly about Haley's math grade, the circumstances of which you knew nothing about, that they asked me to handle communications with the school." The incident sounded only vaguely familiar. It had been safely locked away somewhere in my oxycodone corrupted memory banks, but I felt the burn of embarrassment on my face and neck. I didn't have a comeback. "I have to go," Maggie said quickly. "Haley, I love you. Be good for your father, and I'll see you tomorrow."
"Okay, Mom."
I stared out the window for a moment at my ex-wife before pulling away. "Give him hell, Maggie McPherce," I said. I pulled away from the curb and put my window up. My daughter asked me why her mother was nicknamed Maggie McPherce. "Because when she goes into battle, she always knows she's going to win," I said.
"What battle?"
"Any battle." We drove silently down Ventura Boulevard and stopped for dinner at Dupar's. It was my daughter's favorite place to eat dinner because I always let her order pancakes. Somehow, the kid thought ordering breakfast for dinner was crossing some line, and it made her feel rebellious and brave. I ordered a BLT with Thousand Island dressing on it, and considering my last cholesterol count, figured I was the one being rebellious and brave. We did her homework together, which was a breeze for her and taxing for me, and then I asked her what she wanted to do. I was willing to do anything. A movie, the mall, whatever she wanted. But I was hoping she'd just want to go home to my place and hang out, maybe pull out some old family scrapbooks and look at the yellowed photos. She hesitated in responding, and I thought I knew why. "There's nobody staying at my place, if that's what you're worried about, hey? The lady you met, Lainey, she doesn't visit me anymore."
"You mean like she's not your girlfriend anymore?"
"She never was my girlfriend. She was a friend. Remember when I stayed in the hospital last year? I met her there, and we became friends. We try to watch out for each other, and every now and then she comes over when she doesn't want to stay home alone." It was the shaded truth. Lainey Ross and I had met in rehab during group therapy. We continued the relationship after leaving the program, but never consummated it as a romance, because we were emotionally incapable of it. The addiction had cauterized those nerve endings, and they were slow to come back. We spent time with each other and were there for each other, a two-person support group. But once we were back in the real world, I began to recognize in Lainey a weakness. I instinctively knew she wasn't going to go the distance, and I couldn't make the journey with her. There are three roads that can be taken in recovery. There is the clean path of sobriety, and there's the road to relapse. The third way is the fast out. It is when the traveler realizes that relapse is just a slow suicide, and there's no reason to wait.
I didn't know which of those second two roads Lainey would go down, but I couldn't follow either one. We finally went our separate ways, the day after Haley had met her.
You know, Haley, you can always tell me if you don't like something or there's something I'm doing that is bothering you.
I know.
Good.
We were silent for a few moments, and I thought she wanted to say something else. I gave her the time to work up to it.
Hey, Dad.
What, baby?
If that lady wasn't your girlfriend, does that mean you and Mom might get back together?
The question left me without words for a few moments. I could see the hope in Haley's eyes and wanted her to see the same in mine.
I don't know, hey. I messed things up pretty good when we tried that last year.
Now the pain entered her eyes, like the shadows of clouds on the ocean.
But I'm still working on it, baby, I said quickly. We just have to take it one day at a time. I'm trying to show her that we should be a family again.
She didn't respond. She looked down at her plate.
Okay, baby?
Okay. Did you decide what you want to do?
I think I just want to go home and watch TV.
Good. That's what I want to do. We packed up her school books and I put money down on the bill. On the drive over the hill, she said her mother had told her I'd gotten an important new job. I was surprised, but happy.
Well, it's sort of a new job. I'm going back to work doing what I always did, but I have a lot of new cases and one big one. Did your mom tell you that?
She said you had a big case and everybody would be jealous, but you would do real good.
She said that?
Yeah. I drove for a while, thinking about that and what it might mean. Maybe I hadn't entirely blown things with Maggie. She still respected me on some level. Maybe that meant something.
I looked at my daughter in the rearview mirror. It was dark out now, but I could see her eyes looking out the window and away from mine. Children are so easy to read sometimes, if only grown-ups were the same.
What's up, hey?
I was just wondering, sort of, why you can't do what Mom does.
What do you mean?
Like putting bad people in jail. She said your big case is with a man who killed two people. It's like you're always working for the bad guys.
I was quiet for a moment before finding my words. The man I am defending is accused of killing two people, Haley. Nobody has proved he did anything wrong. Right now, he's not guilty of anything. She didn't respond, and her skepticism was almost palpably emanating from the back seat. So much for the innocence of children.
Haley, what I do is just as important as what your mother does. When somebody is accused of a crime in our country, they are entitled to defend themselves. What if at school you were accused of cheating, and you knew that you didn't cheat? Wouldn't you want to be able to explain and defend yourself?
I think so.
I think so, too. It's like that with the courts. If you get accused of a crime, you can have a lawyer like me help you explain and defend yourself. The laws are very complicated, and it's hard for someone to do it by themselves when they don't know all the rules of evidence and things like that. So I help them. It doesn't mean I agree with them or what they have done, if they have done it. But it's part of the system, an important part.
The explanation felt hollow to me as I said it. On an intellectual level, I understood and believed the argument, every word of it. But on a father-daughter level, I felt like one of my clients, squirming on the witness stand. How could I get her to believe it when I wasn't sure I believed it anymore myself?
Have you helped any innocent people? My daughter asked.
This time I didn't look in the mirror.
A few, yes.
It was the best I could honestly say.
Mom's made a lot of bad people go to jail.
I nodded.
Yes, she has. I used to think we were a great balancing act, what she did and what I did. Now,
there was no need to finish the thought. I turned the radio on and hit the preset button that tuned into the Disney Music Channel. The last thing I thought about on the drive home was that maybe grown-ups were just as easy to read as their children.
After dropping my daughter off at school Thursday morning, I drove directly to Jerry Vincent's law offices. It was still early, and traffic was light. When I got into the garage adjoining the legal center, I found that I almost had my pick of the place. Most lawyers don't get into the office until closer to 9, when court starts. I had all of them beat by at least an hour.
I drove up to the second level so I could park on the same floor as the office. Each level of the garage had its own entrance into the building. I drove by the spot where Jerry Vincent had been parked when he was shot to death, and parked farther up the ramp. As I walked toward the bridge that connected the garage to the legal center, I noticed a parked Subaru station wagon with surfboard racks on the roof. There was a sticker on the back window that showed the silhouette of a surfer riding the nose of a board. It said One World on the sticker. The back windows on the wagon were darkly tinted, and I couldn't see in. I moved up to the front and looked into the car through the driver's side window. I could see that the back seat had been folded flat. Half the rear area was cluttered with open cardboard boxes full of clothes and personal belongings. The other half served as a bed for Patrick Henson. I knew this because he was lying there asleep, his face turned from the light into the folds of a sleeping bag. And it was only then that I remembered something he had said during our first phone conversation, when I had asked if he was interested in a job as my driver. He had told me he was living out of his car and sleeping in a lifeguard stand. I raised my fist to knock on the window, but then decided to let Patrick sleep. I wouldn't need him until later in the morning. There was no need to roust him. I crossed into the office complex, made a turn, and headed down a hallway toward the door marked with Jerry Vincent's name. Standing in front of that door was Detective Bosch. He was listening to his music and waiting for me. He had his hands in his pockets and looked pensive, maybe even a little put out. I was pretty sure we had no appointment, so I didn't know what he was upset about. Maybe it was the music. He pulled out the earbuds as I approached and put them away. "What, no coffee?" I said by way of a greeting. "Not today. I could tell you didn't want it yesterday." He stepped aside so I could use a key to open the door. "Can I ask you something?" I said. "If I said no, you'd ask anyway." "You're probably right." I opened the door. "So then, just ask the question." "All right. Well, you don't seem like an iPod sort of guy to me. Who are you listening to there?" "Somebody I'm sure you never heard of." "I get it. It's Tony Robbins. Self-help guru?" Bosch shook his head, not rising to take the bait. "Frank Morgan," he said. I nodded. "The saxophone player. Yeah, I know Frank." Bosch looked surprised as we entered the reception area. "You know him," he said in a disbelieving tone. "Yeah, I usually drop by and say hello when he plays at the Catalina or the Jazz Bakery. My father loved jazz, and back in the 50s and 60s he was Frank's lawyer. Frank got into a lot of trouble before he got straight. Ended up playing in San Quentin with Art Pepper. You've heard of him, right? By the time I met Frank, he didn't need any help from a defense attorney. He was doing good." It took Bosch a moment to recover from my surprised knowledge of Frank Morgan, the obscure heir to Charlie Parker, who for 2 decades squandered the inheritance on heroin. We crossed the reception area and went into the main office. "So how's the case going?" I asked. "It's going," he said. "I heard that before you came and saw me yesterday, you spent the night in Parker Center sweating a suspect. No arrest, though?" I moved around behind Vincent's desk and sat down. I started pulling the files out of my bag. Bosch stayed standing. "Who told you that?" Bosch asked. There wasn't anything casual about the question. It was more of a demand. I acted nonchalant about it. "I don't know," I said. "I must have heard it somewhere. Maybe a reporter. Who was the suspect?" "That's none of your business." "Then what is my business with you, detective? Why are you here?" "I came to see if you had any more names for me." "What happened to the names I gave you yesterday?" "They've checked out." "How could you check them all out already?" He leaned down and put both hands on the desk. "Because I'm not working this case alone, okay? I have help, and we checked out every one of your names. Every one of them is in jail, dead, or was not worried about Jerry Vincent anymore. We also checked out several of the people he put away as a prosecutor. It's a dead end." I felt a real sense of disappointment, and realized that maybe I'd put too much hope in the possibility of one of those names from the past belonging to the killer, and his arrest being the end of any threat to me. "What about DeMarco, the gun dealer?" "I took that one myself, and it didn't take long to scratch him off the list. He's dead, Holler. Died 2 years ago in his cell up at Corcoran, internal bleeding. When they opened him up, they found a toothbrush shiv lodged in his anal cavity. It was never determined whether he'd put it up there for safekeeping himself or somebody else did it for him, but it was a good lesson for the rest of the inmates. They even put up a sign, "Never put sharp objects up your ass." I leaned back in my seat, as much repelled by the story as by the loss of a potential suspect. I recovered and tried to continue in nonchalant form. "Well, what can I tell you, Detective? DeMarco was my best shot. Those names were all I had. I told you I can't reveal anything about active cases, but here's the deal. There's nothing to reveal." He shook his head in disbelief. "I mean it, Detective. I've been through all the active cases. There is nothing in any of them that constitutes a threat or reason for Vincent to feel threatened. There is nothing in any of them that connects to the FBI. There is nothing in any of them that indicates Jerry Vincent stumbled onto something that put him in harm's way. Besides, when you find out bad things about your clients, they're protected. So there's nothing there. I mean, he wasn't representing mobsters. He wasn't representing drug dealers. There wasn't anything in, he represents murderers. Accused murderers. And at the time of his death, he had only one murder case, Walter Elliott, and there isn't anything there. Believe me, I've looked." I wasn't so sure I believed it as I said it, but Bosch didn't seem to notice. He finally sat down on the edge of the chair in front of the desk, and his face seemed to change. There was an almost desperate look to it. "Jerry was divorced," I offered. "Did you check out the ex-wife?" "They got divorced 9 years ago. She's happily remarried and about to have her second kid. I don't think a woman 7 months pregnant is going to come gunning for an ex-husband she hasn't talked to in 9 years. Any other relatives?" "A mother in Pittsburgh. The family angle is dry." "Girlfriend?" "He was banging his secretary, but there was nothing serious there. And her alibi checks out. She was also banging his investigator, and they were together that night." I felt my face turning red. That sordid scenario wasn't too far from my own current situation. At least Lorna, Cisco, and I had been entangled at different times. I rubbed my face as if I were tired and hoped it would account for my new coloration. "That's convenient," I said, "that they alibi each other." Bosch shook his head. "It checks out through witnesses. They were with friends at a screening at Archway. That big shot client of yours got them the invitation." I nodded and took an educated guess at something, then threw a zinger at Bosch. "The guy you sweated in a room that first night was the investigator, Bruce Carlin." "Who told you that?" "You just did. You had a classic love triangle. It would have been the place to start." "Smart lawyer. But like I said, it didn't pan out. We spent a night on it, and in the morning we were still at square one. Tell me about the money." He'd thrown a zinger right back at me. "What money?" "The money in the business accounts. I suppose you're going to tell me they're protected territory, too." "Actually, I'd probably need to talk to the judge for an opinion on that, but I don't need to bother. My case manager is one of the best accounts people I've ever run across. She's been working with the books, and she tells me they're clean. Every penny Jerry took in is accounted for." Bosch didn't respond, so I continued. "Let me tell you something, Detective. When lawyers get into trouble, most of the time it's because of the money. The books. It's the one place where there are no gray areas. It's the one place where the California bar loves to stick its nose in. I keep the cleanest books in the business because I don't ever want to give them a reason to come after me. So I would know, and Lorna, my case manager, would know, if there was something in these books that didn't add up, but there isn't. I think Jerry probably paid himself a little too quickly, but there's nothing technically wrong with that." I saw Bosch's eyes light on something I had said. "What? What's that mean, he paid himself too quickly?" "It means, let me just start at the start. The way it works is you take on a client and you receive an advance. That money goes into the client trust account. It's their money, but you are holding it because you want to make sure you can get it when you earn it. You follow?" "Yeah, you can't trust your clients because they're criminals. So you get the money up front and you put it in a trust account. Then you pay yourself from it as you do the work." "More or less. Anyway, it's in the trust. And as you do the work, make appearances, prepare the case and so forth, you take your fees from the trust account. You move it into the operating account. Then from the operating account, you pay your own bills and salaries. Rent, secretary, investigator, car costs, and so on and so forth. You also pay yourself. Okay, so how did Vincent pay himself too quickly?
Well, I'm not exactly saying he did. It's a matter of custom and practice. But it looks from the books that he liked to keep a low balance in operating. He happened to have had a franchise client who paid a large advance up front, and that money went through the trust and operating accounts pretty quickly. After costs, the rest went to Jerry Vincent in salary. Bosch's body language indicated I was hitting on something that jibed with something else and was important to him. He had leaned slightly toward me and seemed to have tightened his shoulders and neck.
Walter Elliott, he said. Was he the franchise?
I can't give out that information, but I think it's an easy guess to make. Bosch nodded, and I could see that he was working on something inside. I waited, and he said nothing.
How does this help you, Detective? I finally asked.
I can't give out that information, but I think it's an easy guess to make.
I nodded. He'd nailed me back.
Look, we both have rules we have to follow, I said. We're flip sides of the same coin. I'm just doing my job. And if there's nothing else I can help you with, I'll get back to it.
Bosch stared at me and seemed to be deciding something.
Who did Jerry Vincent bribe on the Elliott case?
He finally asked. The question came out of left field. I wasn't expecting it, but in the moments after he asked it, I realized that it was the question he had come to ask. Everything else up until this point had been window dressing.
What, is that from the FBI?
I haven't talked to the FBI.
Then what are you talking about?
I'm talking about a payoff.
To who?
That's what I'm asking you.
I shook my head and smiled.
Look, I told you, the books are clean.
If you were going to bribe someone with $100,000, would you put it in your books?
I thought about Jerry Vincent and the time I turned down the subtle quid pro quo on the Barnett Woodson case. I turned him down and ended up hanging a not guilty verdict on him. It changed Vincent's life, and he was still thanking me for it from the grave. But maybe it didn't change his ways in the years that followed.
I guess you're right, I said to Bosch.
I wouldn't do it that way.
So what aren't you telling me?
This isn't confidence, Counselor. But I need your help, and I think you need to know this in order to help me.
Okay.
Then say it.
Say what?
That you will treat this information in confidence.
I thought I did. I will. I'll keep it confidential.
Not even your staff. Just you.
Fine. Just me. Tell me.
You have Vincent's work accounts. I have his private accounts. You said he paid himself the money from Elliott quickly.
I didn't say it was Elliott. You did.
Whatever. The point is that 5 months ago, he accumulated $100,000 in a personal investment account and a week later called his broker and told him he was cashing out.
You mean he took $100,000 out in cash?
That's what I just said.
What happened to it?
I don't know. But you can't just go into a broker's and pick up $100,000 in cash. You have to order that kind of money. Took a couple of days to put it together, and then he went in to pick it up. His broker asked a lot of questions to make sure there wasn't a security issue. You know, like somebody being held hostage while he went and got the money. A ransom or something like that. Vincent said everything was fine, that he needed the money to buy a boat, and that if he made the deal in cash, he would get the best deal and save a lot of money.
So where's the boat?
There is no boat. Story was a lie.
Are you sure?
We've checked all state transactions and asked questions all over Marina del Rey and San Pedro. We can't find any boat. We've searched his home twice and reviewed his credit card purchases. No receipts or records of boat-related expenses. No photos, no keys, no fishing poles, no Coast Guard registration. Required on a transaction that large, he didn't buy a boat.
What about Mexico?
Bosch shook his head.
This guy hadn't left L.A. in 9 months. He didn't go down to Mexico and he didn't go anywhere else. I'm telling you, he didn't buy a boat. We would have found it. He bought something else, and your client Walter Elliott probably knows what it was.
I tracked his logic and could see it coming to the doorway of Walter Elliott, but I wasn't going to open it with Bosch looking over my shoulder.
I think you've got it wrong, Detective.
I don't think so, Counselor.
Well, I can't help you. I have no idea about this and have seen no indication of it in any of the books or records I've got. If you can connect this alleged bribe to my client, then arrest him and charge him. Otherwise, I'll tell you right now, he's off limits.
He's not talking to you about this or anything else.
Boss shook his head. I wouldn't waste my time trying to talk to him. He used his lawyer as cover on this, and I'll never be able to get past the attorney-client protection. But you should take it as a warning, counselor.
Yeah? How's that?
Simple. His lawyer got killed, not him. Think about it.
And remember, that little trickle on the back of your neck and running down your spine? That's the feeling you get when you know you have to look over your shoulder. When you know you're in danger.
I smiled back at him.
Oh, is that what that is? I thought it was the feeling I get when I know I'm being bullshitted.
I'm only telling you the truth.
You've been running a game on me for 2 days. Spinning bullshit about bribes and the FBI. You've been trying to manipulate me and it's been a waste of my time. You have to go now, Detective, because I have real work to do.
I stood up and extended a hand toward the door. Bosch stood up but didn't turn to go.
Don't kid yourself, Holler. Don't make a mistake.
Thanks for the advice.
Bosch finally turned and started to leave, but then he stopped and came back to the desk, pulling something from the inside pocket of his jacket as he approached. It was a photograph. He put it down on the desk.
You recognize that man? Bosch asked.
I studied the photo. It was a grainy still taken off a video. It showed a man pushing out through the front door of an office building. This is the front entrance of the legal center, isn't it?
Do you recognize him?
The shot was taken at a distance and blown up, spreading the pixels of the image and making it unclear. The man in the photograph looked to me to be of Latin origin. He had dark skin and hair and had a Pancho Villa mustache, like Cisco used to wear. He wore a Panama hat and an open-collared shirt beneath what appeared to be a leather sport coat. As I looked more closely at the photograph, I realized why it was the frame they had chosen to take from the surveillance video. The man's jacket had pulled open as he'd pushed through the glass door. I could see what looked like the top of a pistol tucked into the beltline of his pants.
Is that a gun? Is this the killer?
Look, can you answer one goddamn question without another question? Do you recognize this man? It's all I want to know.
No, I don't, Detective.
Happy?
That's another question.
Sorry.
You sure you haven't seen him before?
Not 100%, but that's not a great photo you've got there. Where's it from?
A street camera, on Broadway and 2nd. It sweeps the street and we got this guy for only a few seconds. This is the best we can do.
I knew that the city had been quietly installing street cameras on main arteries in the last few years. Streets like Hollywood Boulevard were completely visually wired. Broadway would have been a likely candidate. It was always crowded during the day with pedestrians and traffic. It was also the street used most often for protest marches organized by the underclasses.
Well, then I guess it's better than having nothing. You think the hair and the mustache are a disguise?
Let me ask the questions. Could this guy be one of your new clients?
I don't know. I haven't met them all. Leave me the photo and I'll show it to Wren Williams. She'd know better than me if he's a client.
Bosch reached down and took the photo back.
It's my only copy. When will she be in?
In about an hour.
I'll come back later. Meantime, counselor, watch yourself.
He pointed a finger at me like it was a gun, then turned and walked out of the room, closing the door behind him. I sat there thinking about what he had said and staring at the door, half expecting him to come back in and drop another ominous warning on me. But when the door opened 1 minute later, it was Lorna who entered.
I just saw that detective in the hallway.
Yeah, he was here.
What did he want?
To scare me.
And?
He did a pretty good job.
Lorna wanted to convene another staff meeting and update me on things that had happened while I was out of the office visiting Malibu and Walter Elliott the day before. She even said I had a court hearing scheduled later on a mystery case that wasn't on the calendar we had worked up. But I needed some time to think about what Bosch had just revealed and what it meant.
Where's Cisco?
He's coming. He left early to meet one of his sources before he came into the office.
Did he have breakfast?
Not with me.
Okay. Wait till he gets in and then we'll go over to the dining car and have breakfast. We'll go over everything, man.
I already ate breakfast.
Then you can do all the talking while we do all the eating.
She put a phony frown on her face but went out into the reception office and left me alone. I got up from behind the desk and started to pace the office, hands in my pockets,
trying to evaluate what the information from Bosch meant. According to Bosch, Jerry Vincent had paid a sizable bribe to a person or persons unknown. The fact that the $100,000 came out of the Walter Elliott advance would indicate the bribe was somehow linked to the Elliott case, but this was by no means conclusive. Vincent could easily have used money from Elliott to pay a debt or bribe relating to another case or something else entirely. It could have been a gambling debt he wanted to hide. The only fact was that Vincent had diverted the $100,000 from his account to an unknown destination and had wanted to hide the transaction. Next to consider was the timing of the transaction and whether it was linked to Vincent's murder. Bosch said the money transfer had gone down 5 months ago. Vincent's murder was just 3 nights before, and Elliot's trial was set to begin in a week. Again, there was nothing definitive. The distance between the transaction and the murder seemed to me to strain any possibility of a link between the two. But still, I could not push the two apart, and the reason for this was Walter Elliott himself. Through the filter of Bosch's information, I now began to fill in some answers and to view my client and myself differently. I now saw Elliot's confidence in his innocence and eventual acquittal coming possibly from his belief that it had already been bought and paid for. I now saw his unwillingness to consider delaying the trial as a timing issue relating to the bribe. And I saw his willingness to quickly allow me to carry the torch for Vincent without checking a single reference as a move made so he could get to the trial without delay. It had nothing to do with any confidence in my skills and tenacity. I had not impressed him. I had simply been the one who showed up. I was simply a lawyer who would work in the scheme of things. In fact, I was perfect. I was pulled out of the lost and found bin. I had been on the shelf and was hungry and ready. I could be dusted off and suited up and sent in to replace Vincent, no questions asked. The reality jolt this sent through me was as uncomfortable as the first night in rehab, but I also understood that this self-knowledge could give me an edge. I was in the middle of some sort of play, but at least now I knew it was a play. That was an advantage. I could now make it my own play. There was a reason for the hurry up to trial, and I now thought I knew what it was. The fix was in. Money had been paid for a specific fix, and that fix was tied to the trial remaining on schedule. The next question in this string was why? Why must the trial take place as scheduled? I didn't have an answer for that yet, but I was going to get it. I walked over to the windows and split the Venetian blinds with my hand. Out on the street, I saw a van from Channel 5 parked with two wheels up on the curb. A camera crew and a reporter were on the sidewalk, and they were getting ready to do a live shot, offering their viewers the latest on the Vincent case, the latest being the exact same report given the morning before. No arrests, no suspects, no news. I left the window and stepped back into the middle of the room to continue my pacing. The next thing I needed to consider was the man in the photograph Bosch showed me. There was a contradiction at work here. The early indications of evidence were that Vincent had known the person who killed him and allowed him to get close. But the man in the photograph appeared to be in disguise. Would Jerry have lowered his window for the man in the photograph? The fact that Bosch had zeroed in on this man didn't make sense when applied to what was known about the crime scene. The calls from the FBI to Vincent's cell phone were also part of the unknown equation. What did the Bureau know, and why had no agent come forward to Bosch? It might be that the agency was hiding its tracks, but I also knew that it might not want to come out of the shadows to reveal an ongoing investigation. If this was the case, I would need to step more carefully than I had been. If I ended up the least bit tainted in a federal corruption probe, I would never recover from it. The last unknown to consider was the murder itself. Vincent had paid the bribe and was ready for trial as scheduled. Why had he become a liability? His murder certainly threatened the timetable and was an extreme response. Why was he killed? There were too many questions and too many unknowns for now. I needed more information before I could draw any solid conclusions about how to proceed. But there was a basic conclusion I couldn't stop myself from reaching. It seemed uncomfortably clear that I was being mushroomed by my own client. Elliot was keeping me in the dark about the interior machinations of the case. but that could work both ways. I decided that I would do exactly what Bosch had asked. Keep the information the detective had given me confidential. I would not share it with my staff, and certainly at this point, I would not question Walter Elliott about his knowledge of these things. I would keep my head above the dark waters of the case and keep my eyes wide open. I shifted focus from my thoughts to what was directly in front of me. I was looking at the gaping mouth of Patrick Henson's fish. The door opened, and Lorna re-entered the office to find me standing there, staring at the tarpon. "What are you doing?" she asked. "Thinking." "Well, Cisco's here, and we've got to go. You have a busy court schedule today, and I don't want to make you late." "Then let's go. I'm starved." I followed her out, but not before glancing back at the big, beautiful fish hanging on the wall. I thought I knew exactly how he felt. I had Patrick drive us over to the Pacific dining car, and Cisco and I ordered steak and eggs while Lorna had tea and honey. The dining car was a place where downtown power brokers like to gather before a day of fighting it out in the glass towers nearby. The food was overpriced, but good. It instilled confidence, made the downtown warrior feel like a heavy hitter. As soon as the waiter took our order and left us, Lorna put her silverware to the side and opened a spiral-bound, at-a-glance calendar on the table. "Eat fast," she said. "You have a busy day." "Tell me." "All right, the easy stuff first." She flipped a couple of pages back and forth in the calendar, then proceeded. "You have a 10 a.m. in chambers with Judge Holder. She wants an updated client inventory."
"She told me I had a week," I protested. "Today's Thursday."
"Yeah, well, Mike Ella called and said the judge wants an interim update. I think she, the judge, that is, saw in the paper that you are continuing on as Elliot's lawyer. She's afraid you're spending all your time on Elliot and none on the other clients."
"That's not true. I filed a motion for Patrick yesterday, and Tuesday I took the sentencing on Reese. I mean, I haven't even met all the clients yet."
"Don't worry. I have a hard copy inventory back at the office for you to take with you. It shows who you've met, who you signed up, and calendars on all of them. Just hit her with the paperwork, and she won't be able to complain." I smiled. Lorna was the best case manager in the business.
"Great. What else?"
"Then, at 11, you have an in-chambers with Judge Stanton on Elliot."
"Status conference?"
"Yes. He wants to know if you're going to be able to go next Thursday."
"No, but Elliot won't have it any other way."
"Well, the judge will get to hear Elliot say that for himself. He's requiring the defendant's presence."
That was unusual. Most status conferences were routine and quick. The fact that Stanton wanted Elliot there bumped this one up into a more important realm. I thought of something and pulled out my cell phone.
"Did you let Elliot know?"
"He might."
"Put it away. He knows and he'll be there. I talked to his assistant, Mrs. Albrecht, this morning, and she knows he has to show and that the judge can revoke if he doesn't." I nodded. It was a smart move. Threaten Elliot's freedom as a means of making sure he shows up.
"Good," I said. "That's it?"
I wanted to get to Cisco to ask what else he'd been able to find out about the Vincent investigation and whether his sources had mentioned anything about the man in the surveillance photo Bosch had shown me.
"Not by a long shot, my friend," Lorna responded.
"Now we get to the mystery case."
"Let's hear it."
"We got a call yesterday afternoon from Judge Friedman's clerk, who called Vincent's office blind to see if there was anyone there taking over the cases. When the clerk was informed that you were taking over, she asked if you were aware of the hearing scheduled before Friedman today at 2. I checked our new calendar, and you didn't have a 2 o'clock on there for today. So, there is the mystery. You have a hearing at 2 for a case we not only don't have on calendar, but don't have a file for either."
"What's the client's name?"
"Eli Wims."
It meant nothing to me. "Did Wren know the name?"
Lorna shook her head in a dismissive way.
"Did you check the dead cases? Maybe it was just misfiled."
"No, we checked. There is no file anywhere in the office."
"And what's the hearing? Did you ask the clerk?"
Lorna nodded. "Pretrial motions. Wims is charged with attempted murder of a peace officer and several other weapons-related charges. He was arrested May 2nd at a county park in Calabasas. He was arraigned, bound over, and sent to Camarillo for 90 days. He must have been found competent because the hearing today is to set a trial date and consider bail."
I nodded. From the shorthand,
I could read between the lines. Wims had gotten into some sort of confrontation involving weapons with the sheriff's department, which provided law enforcement services in the unincorporated area known as Calabasas. He was sent to the state's mental evaluation center in Camarillo, where the shrinks took 3 months deciding whether he was a crazy man or competent to stand trial on the charges against him. The docs determined he was competent, meaning he knew right from wrong when he tried to kill a peace officer, most likely the sheriff's deputy who confronted him. It was a bare-bones sketch of the trouble Eli Wims was in. There would be more detail in the file, but we had no file. "Is there any reference to Wims in the trust account deposits?" I asked. Lorna shook her head. I should have assumed she would be thorough and check the bank accounts in search of Eli Wims. "Okay, so it looks like maybe Jerry took him on pro bono." Attorneys occasionally provide legal services free of charge, pro bono, to indigent or special clients. Sometimes this is an altruistic endeavor, and sometimes it's because the client just won't pay up. Either way, the lack of an advance from Wims was understandable. The missing file was another story. "You know what I was thinking?" Lorna said. "What?" "That Jerry had the file with him, in his briefcase, when he left Monday night. And it got taken, along with his laptop and cell phone, by the killer." She nodded, and I nodded back. It made sense. He was spending the evening preparing for the week, and he had a hearing Thursday on Wims. Maybe he had run out of gas and thrown the file in his briefcase to look at later. Or maybe he kept the file with him because it was important, in a way I couldn't see yet. Maybe the killer wanted the Wims file, and not the laptop or the cell phone. "Who's the prosecutor on the case?" "Joanne Giorgetti, and I'm way ahead of you. I called her yesterday and explained our situation and asked if she wouldn't mind copying the discovery again for us. She said no problem. You can pick it up after your 11 with Judge Stanton, and then have a couple hours to familiarize yourself with it before the hearing at 2. Joanne Giorgetti was a top-flight prosecutor who worked in the Crimes Against Law Officers section of the DA's office. She was also a longtime friend of my ex-wife's and was my daughter's basketball coach in the YMCA League. She'd always been cordial and collegial with me, even after Maggie and I split up. It didn't surprise me that she would run off a copy of the discovery materials for me." "You think of everything, Lorna," I said. "Why don't you just take over Vincent's practice and run with it? You don't need me." She smiled at the compliment, and I saw her eyes flick in the direction of Cisco. The read I got was that she wanted him to realize her value to the law firm of Michael Haller and Associates. "I like working in the background," she said. "I'll leave center stage for you." Our plates were served, and I spread a liberal dose of Tabasco sauce on both my steak and the eggs. Sometimes hot sauce was the only way I knew I was still alive. I was finally able to hear what Cisco had come up with on the Vincent investigation, but he dug into his meal, and I knew better than to try to keep him from his food. I decided to wait and asked Lorna how things were working out with Wren Williams. She answered in a low voice, as if Wren were sitting nearby in the restaurant and listening. "She's not a lot of help, Mickey. She seems to have no idea of how the office worked or where Jerry put things. She'd be lucky to remember where she parked her car this morning. If you ask me, she was working there for some other reason." I could have told her the reason, as it had been told to me by Bosch, but decided to keep it to myself. I didn't want to distract Lorna with gossip. I looked over and saw Cisco mopping up the steak juice and hot sauce on his plate with a piece of toast. He was good to go. "What do you have going today, Cisco?"
"I'm working on Riltz and his side of the equation."
"How's that going?"
"I think there'll be a couple of things you can use. You want to hear about it?"
"Not yet. I'll ask when I need it." I didn't want to be given any information about Riltz that I might have to turn over to the prosecution in discovery. At the moment, the less I knew, the better. Cisco understood this and nodded.
"I also have the Bruce Carlin debriefing this afternoon," Cisco added.
"He wants $200 an hour, Lorna said. "Highway robbery, if you ask me." I waved off her protest.
"Just pay it. It's a one-time expense, and he probably has information we can use. And that might save Cisco some time."
"Don't worry. We're paying him. I'm just not happy about it. He's gouging us because he knows he can. Technically, he's gouging Elliot, and I don't think he's going to care." I turned back to my investigator.
"You have anything new on the Vincent case?"
Cisco updated me with what he had. It consisted mostly of forensic details. suggesting that the source he had inside the investigation came from that side of the equation. He said Vincent had been shot twice, both times in the area of the left temple. The spread on the entry wounds was less than an inch, and powder burns on the skin and hair indicated the weapon was 9 to 12 inches away when fired. Sisko said this indicated that the killer had fired two quick shots and was fairly skilled. It was unlikely that an amateur would fire twice quickly and be able to cluster the impacts. Additionally, Sisko said, the slugs never left the body and were recovered during the autopsy conducted the day before. They were 25s, he said. I had handled countless cross-examinations of tool marks and ballistics experts. I knew my bullets, and I knew a 25 caliber round came out of a small weapon but could do great damage, especially if fired into the cranial vault. The slugs would ricochet around inside. It would be like putting the victim's brain in a blender. They know the exact weapon yet? I knew that by studying the markings, lands and grooves, on the slugs, they would be able to tell what kind of gun fired the rounds. Just as with the Malibu murders, in which the investigators knew what gun had been used, even though they didn't have it. Yeah, a 25 caliber Beretta Bobcat, nice and small, you could almost hide it in your hand. A completely different weapon than the one used to kill Mitzi Elliott and Johann Rieltz. So what's all of this tell us? It's a hitter's gun. You take it when you know it's going to be a headshot. I nodded my agreement. So this was planned. The killer knew just what he was going to do. He waits in the garage, sees Jerry come out, and comes right up to the car. The window goes down, or it was already down, and the guy pops Jerry twice in the head, then reaches in for the briefcase that has the laptop, the cell phone, the portfolio, and, we think, the Eli Wims file.
Exactly. Okay, what about the suspect? The guy they sweated the first night?
No, that was Carlin. They cut him loose. Sisko looked surprised.
How'd you find out it was Carlin?
Bosch told me this morning.
Are you saying they have another suspect?
I nodded. He showed me a photo of a guy coming out of the building at the time of the shooting. He had a gun and was wearing an obvious disguise. I saw Sisko's eyes flare. It was a point of professional pride that he provide me with information like that. He didn't like it happening the other way around. He didn't have a name, just the photo, I said. He wanted to know if I had ever seen the guy before, or if it was one of the clients. Sisko's eyes darkened as he realized that his inside source was holding out on him. If I'd told him about the FBI calls, he probably would have picked the table up and thrown it through the window.
I'll see what I can find out, he said quietly through a tight jaw.
I looked at Lorna. Bosch said he was coming back later to show the photo to Wren. I'll tell her.
Make sure you look at it, too. I want everybody to be on alert for this guy.
Okay, Mickey.
I nodded. We were finished. I put a credit card on the table and pulled out my cell phone to call Patrick. Calling my driver reminded me of something.
Sisko, there's one other thing I want you to try to do today. Sisko looked at me, happy to move on from the idea that I had a better source on the investigation than he did. Go to Vincent's liquidator and see if he's sitting on one of Patrick's surfboards. If he is, I want it back for Patrick.
Sisko nodded. I can do that. No problem.
Waylaid by the slow-moving elevators and the CCB, I was 4 minutes late when I walked into Judge Holder's courtroom and hustled through the clerk's corral toward the hallway leading to her chambers. I didn't see anyone, and the door was closed. I knocked lightly, and I heard the judge call for me to enter. She was behind her desk and wearing her black robe. This told me she probably had a hearing in open court scheduled soon, and my being late was not a good thing. Mr. Holler, our meeting was set for 10 o'clock. I believe you were given proper notice of this.
Yes, Your Honor, I know. I'm sorry. The elevators in this building are... All lawyers take the same elevators and most seem to be on time for meetings with me.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you bring your checkbook?
I think so, yes.
Well, we can do this one of two ways, the judge said. I can hold you in contempt of court, fine you, and let you explain yourself to the California bar, or we can go informal,
and you can take out your checkbook and make a donation to the Make-A-Wish Foundation. It's one of my favorite charities. They do good things for sick children. This was incredible. I was being fined for being 4 minutes late. The arrogance of some judges was amazing. I was somehow able to swallow my outrage and speak.
I like the idea of helping out sick children, Your Honor, I said. How much do I make it out for?
As much as you want to contribute, and I will even send it in for you.
She pointed to a stack of paperwork on the left side of her desk. I saw two other checks, most likely stroked out by two other poor bastards who'd run afoul of the judge this week. I leaned down and rummaged through the front pocket of my backpack until I found my checkbook. I wrote a check for $250 to Make-A-Wish, tore it out, and handed it across the desk. I watched the judge's eyes as she looked at the amount I was donating. She nodded approvingly, and I knew I was all right.
Thank you, Mr. Haller. They'll be sending you a receipt for your taxes in the mail. It will go to the address on the check.
Like you said, they do good work.
Yes, they do.
The judge put the check on top of the two others and then turned her attention back to me.
Now, before we go over the cases, let me ask you a question, she said. Do you know if the police are making any headway on the investigation of Mr. Vincent's death?
I hesitated a moment, wondering what I should be telling the chief judge of the Superior Court.
I'm not really in the loop on that, Judge, I said, but I was shown a photograph of a man I assume they're looking at as a suspect.
Really? What kind of photo?
Like a surveillance shot from out on the street? A guy, and it looks like he has a gun. I think they matched it up time-wise to the shooting in the garage.
Did you recognize the man?
I shook my head. No, the shot was too grainy. It looked like he might have had a disguise on anyway.
When was this?
The night of the